Behind their seemingly effortless playing were thousands of hours logged performing together in the clubs of Liverpool and Hamburg. This FaceTime forged the Beatles into a cohesive, tightly knit team that Rolling Stone's Mick Jagger called enviously the four-headed Hydra. Together, the Beatles sold over 236 million albums worldwide, and they were only active as a band for about 10 years. As individual artists, if you took all of their album sales together, having had many more decades to create music, they still haven't sold half as many records as they did together as the Beatles. When they worked together, they were more than the sum of their parts. This is also a foundational idea of Buckminster Fuller in his understanding of the universe. He showed that a system with forces working together could be more powerful and more useful. He said, "Don't fight forces, use them."
Welcome to Meridians.
The tiny house movement until the 2000s was just that. It was tiny. It wasn't even really a movement as far as I could tell. Some authors before that had talked about living simply, such as Henry David Thoreau, but that was back in the mid-1800s, and many people were living simply back then because it was the 1800s, and that was just life. No, the modern tiny house movement was really started by Jay Schaefer, with some inspiration from Lester Walker and others before him. It was kind of just him, though, and a few random individuals out there, maybe, unaware of each other. But in 1997, Jay Schaefer was an art student in grad school, and he was studying painting. He would say that composition in art is always about what is necessary and eliminating everything else. If it's not contributing to the composition, it's weakening it. So I just figured the same thing goes for every work of art and every life. Keep that in mind throughout this episode, because Jay's a lot smarter than he might realize. So he also read a book called Tiny Houses, and it was written by Lester Walker, which I mentioned. And that book was published in 1993, but it didn't really inspire the movement, you know, Jay Schaefer would later. But it inspired Jay Schaefer, so, you know, by proxy, I guess you could say Lester Walker started the movement. But in the late 90s, Schaefer felt the average American could no longer afford a home. In his mind, houses were being built for profit, not for people. He also spent some time living in an Airstream trailer, and he liked the simplicity of it. In a later documentary, he was asked why he built tiny houses, and the reasons he stated were actually, he said he didn't like vacuuming or taking care of a bunch of stuff he doesn't need. This was really an off-the-cuff answer. I'm sure he didn't have time to think out his whole philosophy. But he did also bring up environmental reasons, like contributing less greenhouse gases and the use of non-renewable resources would be much less in a tiny house. He began building a very small tiny house on wheels in 1997 and simultaneously started writing a book about his decision to make his home so tiny. This book was titled The Small House Book, and it was completed in the summer of 1999, coinciding with Schaefer moving in to his newly built tiny house. And Schaefer's writing in his tiny house would slowly gain attention. This house of his was considered one of the first modern tiny houses. The Small House Book would actually go on, became highly popular at Amazon for being the most sought after, sold out publication. And that's probably kind of what starts the kindling of this tiny house movement, the sale of the Small House Book. You start getting some people behind it. But in 1999, Jay Schaefer also founded a company called Tumbleweed, which was a tiny house company. It was just focused on building sheds and chicken coops, but into the 2000s, they started to build a few tiny homes here and there. It never seemed like it was a big operation, though. We're talking like a few houses a year. Into the 2000s, though, the tiny house movement would start to pick up steam. Schaefer co-founded the Small House Society in 2002, and their mission was to support the research, development, and use of smaller living spaces that foster sustainable living for individuals, families, and communities worldwide. And it was described as sort of a voice for the small house movement. They would promote discussion about the ecological, economical, and psychological impacts of excessive housing. They'd advocate for smaller, simple living spaces, but don't push for like extreme downsizing. Supporters live in homes ranging from 140 to over 4,000 square feet. So we're not talking crazy. They're just saying generally people don't need giant houses. As for Tumbleweed, they would slowly grow in the 2000s. It was kind of it wasn't like a frenzy on tiny houses. I mean, it was sort of a DIY community in the first place. So not everyone is going to have this prefab tiny house that they're building themselves. There were handy people all over the country that could start building their own homes. But that's when things started to go crazy, at least for Schaefer and the movement. In 2007, Jay Schaefer appeared on Oprah, and he was featured on the show giving a tour of one of his tiny houses. Instantly, people were kind of hooked on this idea. Not necessarily on actually buying tiny houses, some certainly were, but the idea that really resonated with people as, you know, almost a spectacle too. And it probably made a lot of people think about the way they were living differently too. But this media coverage would spawn hundreds of other media outlets reaching out to him. And, you know, it hit the media cycle pretty hard. And at a time when things were getting pretty bad for housing. In 2007, 2009, the housing market in the United States, it took a giant shit. And people were underwater on their mortgage, meaning they owed more than their homes were worth. This combined with massive fraud and from banks, and it just tumbled down in a heap, caused a giant mess, which most people are familiar with. But so with the housing market in the toilet and the tiny house movement having as much exposure as ever, the idea was really getting more attention now. So for some people, it would help them refocus their lives on what matters. The idea was that you could just spend your time doing things you cared about, not worrying about your mortgage or your property taxes, or if you're about to lose everything with one phone call from your boss. As for Tumbleweed, the movement didn't really grow the business, not as far as I could tell. They were still only building a few houses a year by 2011, 2012. Schaefer actually left the company. He basically admitted that he didn't like the business side of things, and for whatever reason, him and his partners parted ways. I've seen Jay in several interviews, and he's a really cool guy. He's not trying to be some kind of evangelist salesperson, though. He really just seems to like he believes in the movement, and he isn't trying to get rich off of it. He's an artist at heart, he seems like, and he's got his heart in the right place, but it didn't really seem like he cared for making much money, let's put it that way. So from here, in 2012, Schaefer started a new company, though, called Four Lights Tiny House Company. He probably wanted his creative freedom a little more. But Four Lights would focus more on offering hands-on workshops, books, and developing tiny home communities. Around this time, there were still probably only thousands of tiny homes in the USA. From what I can tell, this movement was just never huge. So it did get a lot of attention because people were fascinated by the concept. So in 2014, when the Netflix show Tiny House Nation came out, it was a huge success, and it gave even more attention to the tiny house movement and industry. This honestly seems to me like when things started to sour more. Schaefer himself says that around this time, people started making moves in the industry and it became really commercial and problematic. Schaefer would eventually kind of slowly fade into the background of this movement, and it was just getting too crazy for him. There were also all kinds of problems with fraud. There were people putting on workshops using his name, only to take people's money and bail out on the workshops. And, you know, and they would blame him, you know, they'd say, oh, well, Schaefer didn't show up. Sorry, no refunds kind of thing. And then people would get mad at Schaefer, and he had nothing to do with it. He was also getting these weird, frivolous lawsuits, which are called slap suits. And it's basically it's just litigious people trying to squeeze money out of him. You know, they think he's got some success. From what I can tell, J. Schaefer never became rich. He doesn't seem like he became a rich guy off of this whole tiny house movement. I saw a later interview with him where he showed one of his tiny houses, though, and it was actually in his backyard. He was actually living with his wife and kids in it was about 1,000 square foot house next to the tiny house. I mean, his tiny houses were extremely small. They're only about 100 square feet. You probably couldn't even legally live in 100 square feet with a child if you wanted to. But he was living a simple life still. And I'm not trying to like call him out or anything for not living in a tiny house and walking the walk forever. He clearly got himself out of the limelight, though. Today, he's not really on social media, and his blog has kind of a thick layer of dust on it. It just doesn't seem like he cares to be present and engage with people as much. You know, having said that, he did do a web interview recently, though, that I saw. It was on YouTube, and it was with some tiny house group. He did this like this summer in the middle of 2024. And having seen a few interviews with him over the years, he just looked kind of worn out in this interview. Like most of the interview, he's talking about problems in the industry. I think that was kind of the topic, was the dark side of tiny houses. But he genuinely seemed depressed about it. Like he wasn't just like, well, here was what the things, he was like, he definitely wasn't over it. He just seemed downtrodden about the whole thing. But despite all the media, the mess and frenzy with it, tiny houses, they have their benefits. The movement as a whole, it kind of addresses multiple issues simultaneously, right? Including like affordability, environmental concerns, and I mean, even homelessness. If you could scale up and build plenty of these tiny houses, there should be plenty of room for more housing. But to bring this back to what I said up front, why did I bring up the Beatles at all? Well, the Beatles, they created a kind of synergy by being more as a band than the total of their individual talents. Well, that tiny house movement also has this kind of synergy in a way by solving multiple problems with one solution. It's kind of a way of doing more with less. And this concept and this term synergy, it's going to come up later. That's kind of why I'm bringing it up now. But if you haven't heard of the term, it simply means that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. But we'll get into that more, and we'll find that Buckminster Fuller takes this concept to a whole new level. The tiny house movement, for its part, it continues to grow. There's already these tiny house communities all over. There's over 50 of them across the country. See, not a huge movement, right? 50 communities is not exactly huge. You know, there's millions of communities around the country, right? Around the United States. But it's still cool to see the subculture of people out there. I mean, they found common ground in their desire to live simpler and to be more environmentally friendly, to live with less stress, no paycheck to paycheck with some giant mortgage. Would it be so bad if we all lived a little more simple that way? It's a whole just mindset and lifestyle change. You know, everything in the United States anyway, the way we grew up, it just kind of goes against that. But for once to have a movement take off and actually go against this like consumption cycle it's kind of interesting. My hats are off to the people who made that leap. I don't know if I could ever live in a tiny house per se, but they're interesting as an idea at least, but I don't know if it's right for me. I do think that my takeaway is that I could definitely live more simply with less things and probably get more out of my life by doing so. So, and that's my way of doing more with less, and so be it. But now I want to get into the thing that really spurred me to want to do this episode in the first place. So to do that, we're going to go backwards in time now to 1943. Have you ever heard the word Dymaxion? It's a term coined by architect and inventor Buckminster Fuller. Dymaxion is a blended word that combines dynamic, maximum, and tension to gain maximum advantage from minimal energy input. So Fuller would use this term in regards to several of his ideas and inventions. We're going to talk about several of them over the course of this podcast, but there was the Dymaxion car. It looked kind of like a teardrop, and honestly, it was ugly as shit, but it was efficient. But then there was the Dymaxion map project, a map that sort of showed the entire surface of the Earth as one big island. We'll talk about that later, too. And then there was the Dymaxion house. And we're going to talk largely about Fuller's life, but first, to segue, let's talk about the Dymaxion house. So here's an article from 1943 on Buckminster Fuller, and it talks about the Dymaxion house quite a bit. The headline was, "His startling inventions may affect our post-war destiny." So yeah, we're in the middle of 1943, so we're talking in the middle of World War II. But so they say, for almost two decades, Buckminster Fuller has been applying himself to the problems of technology in living, arguing that the machine and the machine tool are properly an extension of the human body, and that technical efficiency applied to living is an essential if civilization is to advance. He calls the idea the Dymaxion principle. It then goes on to talk about the house itself. And this is a full-scale house planned for mass production and intended to be sold at the price of small cars. This house, containing two master bedrooms, two baths, a study, a kitchen, living room, garage, workshop, sun deck, as well as complete air conditioning and heating equipment, is planned to sell at under $1,000 and to be erected within 3 hours from the time of delivery. Future prices can be said to hang around the $676 mark, or about 1/13th of what you would pay now for a house of similar space, but 1/100th as efficient. Then it gets really Jetsons-like. He goes on, the article goes on, prefabricated Dymaxion bathrooms, dish and clothes closets designed to revolve so that the storage space will move around you and not vice versa. The article goes on to describe how the house will have all these efficiencies and change the way people live and et cetera, et cetera. It's a pretty neat article for its time. So 50 years before Jay Schaefer would start a small, simple movement to efficient housing, the Dymaxion house was already an idea. And it wasn't just a small house, though. It was designed to be highly efficient and functional in its use of space. And it wasn't nearly as tiny as a tiny home. We're talking about, I think it was about 1,000 square feet. So what did this Dymaxion house look like? Well, I'm sorry, but in a word, it was ugly. It was pretty ugly. It was a cylindrical shape with a sloped cone roof that had like a central part of the roof that could rotate to promote airflow. It was like a mast. It would catch air in the wind. So it was also stainless steel. It kind of looked like an Airstream trailer from the outside with this highly reflective metal all around the sides and roof. The rooms were sort of divided up like pie wedges, with most of the storage and utility kind of being in the central part of the structure. But I almost think of it more as one giant room with spoked partitions radiating from the center. And these partitions, they didn't like necessarily go to the ceiling, at least in the model that I saw, which is the only model. The ventilation would just come down from the ceiling and create a sort of wind tunnel to circulate air around the house. the idea was that you could sort of tailor the house design to your needs, sort of like a modular type system. But none of these things is what made the house Dymaxion. What made it Dymaxion was how the walls and ceilings worked. So I'm just going to quote this really lovely tour guide from a YouTube video about the Dymaxion house. And it's the house that's in the Henry Ford Museum in Detroit. And she said, "The secret of the Dymaxion house lies in its central construction. Buckminster Fuller was trying to change the way we thought about structure in order to address certain things like extreme weather conditions. So we have a central mast and network of pillars that are driven 8 feet into the ground into a slab of concrete, from which you have a network of suspension cables that reach across or lattice across one another that hang onto the floor. It's in essence this high tension which holds the walls in the upright position. However, the suspension style cables, they expand and contract, and they grant this house a measure of agility no other house has. When combined with a plexiglass exterior, you have a house that functions like an airplane, able to withstand drops in pressure. It can adjust its shape and change itself according to those values. And that's the thing that makes the house really unique, and that's what makes the house a Dymaxion house." And the house was designed to be mass-produced and kind of folded up like an accordion and put on a flatbed truck and moved to a location. So that's great, right? But what happened? How many did they build? They built one. One goddamn Dymaxion house. The one in the Henry Ford Museum is the Dymaxion house. Now, to be clear, Fuller did design something that came earlier called the Dymaxion Deployment Units, or DDUs, and those were a bit smaller and looked like grain silos. They were much simpler, and they were designed to be used for soldiers returning from World War II. There was a housing shortage, and Fuller had an idea for the solution. So while Jay Schaefer is no Buckminster Fuller in terms of inventiveness and engineering prowess, you could safely argue that his tiny house movement was actually much more successful than Fuller's Dymaxion house, which, I mean, it wasn't really commercially successful at all. It did seem like several of the DDUs were built for the military, and some even seemed to be shipped to North Africa to be used by the military there, but they didn't have any widespread use. The real problem with getting the Dymaxion housing project off the ground was investment, and I will be getting into that later, but it was going to cost around $10 million to outfit a factory to mass produce these houses. And it was just kind of a big gamble to go on. But then there was also criticism from people that the design was inflexible. Every house would basically look the same from the outside. Kind of reminds you of like Edward Scissorhands or some kind of even more dystopian vision. But plus it just wasn't adaptable to different environments and landscapes. You know, not every house sits on a flat surface, right? So while it would have been really cool to see this Dymaxion housing project take off a little bit, you know, maybe it could have inspired other projects down the road that would have, you know, maybe they wouldn't have been so cookie cutter or ugly houses, but this project just wasn't meant to be. Now let's take a look at Buckminster Fuller in a more complete way and take a look at his life. Okay, who was Buckminster Fuller? Before researching him, I can honestly say I didn't really know who he was. Though I definitely heard that name before, it's such a peculiar name, Buckminster. Apparently he was referred to as Bucky by his friends and colleagues. But he's got just this list of achievements that's so long that I probably won't even be able to cover them all. I mean, he was actually quite a genius in the truest sense of the word. But he didn't just pop out of the womb and become some kind of super genius and have all this commercial success left and right, as we've already seen. He had his struggles, but he went through a lot of struggles, especially in his early years. And it really shaped him in a way. And he's kind of very inspirational in his inability to give up, as we'll see. So he had a decent upbringing. He was born in Milton, Massachusetts in the summer of 1895. As a child, he would spend much of his time on Bear Island off the coast of Maine in Penobscot Bay. And this was an island his family actually owned, but it was still a fairly primitive place from the sounds of it. They'd have to chop their own wood for heat, and they didn't have electricity. I mean, considering the time, we're just turning into the 20th century, and you know, it probably was the norm for a house on an island probably wasn't going to have electricity. So he was a pretty deep thinker at a young age. He actually had a vision problem, though, that would make him stand out from the other kids. But the questions he would ask his teachers probably made him stand out a little bit more. He'd ask questions like, what does a square weigh, and what temperature of different shapes? So this kind of gives a peek into his mind. He didn't take things for granted, and he didn't just accept the reality he was handed. He was a border collie, and his mind needed stimulation. He would contemplate ideas and come up with his creative inventions, and he would even make his own tools from materials he found in the woods. When he was 12, he invented a push-pull system for propelling a rowboat by use of an inverted umbrella connected to the transom, so like the flat back part of the boat, with a simple oar lock, which allowed the user to face forward to point the boat in its direction, and you'd kind of just pump this thing back and forth to make the boat move. He was 12 years old when he came up with this. And this time in Fuller's life would be pretty foundational for him, because he really got his interest in design, and it also, he started to understand the importance of being knowledgeable about the materials he was using. But back on the mainland, Fuller would attend Milton Academy in Massachusetts, and this would be followed up by him inevitably going to Harvard. I say inevitably because he would be the fifth generation of men from his family to attend Harvard. However, Fuller did not take to college very well. Fuller described himself as a non-conforming misfit in the fraternity environment. And at Harvard, he was not admitted to any of the prestigious social clubs because he sounded like his family had money. He's got five generations of men in his family. They had their own island, but still, he didn't have the kind of resources some of these other people had. And he ended up being expelled after a year for spending all his money partying with a vaudeville troupe. I wish I could have learned more about that, but that is the majority. That's basically all I heard. I don't know. It sounds kind of worth it to me. I don't know. But after being expelled, and this was 1914 now, his family was not too thrilled with him. They sent him off to work as an apprentice in a textile mill in Quebec, Canada. They wanted to straighten out the wayward Bucky. But during this time, Fuller gained a practical understanding of machinery and engineering. So he traded in the theoretical education for a more practical one, at least for a while. In the fall of that year, he would be reinstated at Harvard. So you're thinking, great, back to study, time to fall in line, right? No, the next year he was expelled again, this time for just a lack of overall ambition, though it kind of seemed like, you know, they probably just, he just wasn't taking to their methods. So he squandered his tuition money the first time, got kicked out, and then his family tried to straighten him out, and then they sent him back, and then he got kicked out again. So this time, from here on out, Fuller would be educated. He would continue to educate himself, but on his own terms. But he had to make money, and his family sent him to work at a meatpacking plant in New York City. And he would work the 3 a.m. to 3 p.m. shift. So Fuller was kind of incubated for a while, working a hard job, and it probably gave him some serious perspective in life, but it also gave him time off to study on his own and learn. Now in 1917, July 12th of that year, which also happened to be Fuller's birthday, he married a young woman, Anne Hewlett, who worked as a cashier and accountant for the meat packer, presumably the same one he worked for anyway. They would remain married for the rest of his life. And that same year, though, the United States entered World War I. Fuller would join the Navy, and he joined the Navy because the Army had rejected him because of that poor eyesight that he still had. But in an effort to not be rejected by the Navy, Fuller volunteered his family's cabin cruiser boat. So him, along with a crew of six that included his brother Wally, would patrol up and down the coast of Maine looking for German U-boats, apparently. But later in 1918, Fuller would attend a three-month short training course at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. And then he would serve in the Navy. He would serve in the Navy from 1917 to 1919. And, you know, he served as a radio operator, a bosun. He edited a news publication. And he also was a commander of crash rescue boats. It's not clear if he went to Europe to fight the war, but he said that he was present for several rescues of naval pilots. So it sounds like he might have been out in the Atlantic, at least. I mean, maybe he was rescuing them from, you know, maybe they crashed during drills, but it's kind of unclear. A little bit more of that myth building, maybe. But it doesn't matter. 1919, the war's over. Fuller resigned from the Navy so that he could spend more time with his family. And now he's got a family. He's married, and he has a child, a little girl. Unfortunately, this little girl contracted spinal meningitis and infantile paralysis. So this would be a difficult time in Fuller's life, obviously. In 1922, Fuller's daughter would actually die from her illness. And despite this, and probably as a distraction from her death, Fuller joined with his father-in-law, James Monroe Hewlett, in his architectural firm. Together, they would form a construction company called Stockade Building Company to build houses using prefabricated fiber blocks that Hewlett actually invented. So James Monroe Hewlett was a bit of a clever man himself. He had come up with a modular block out of compressed fiber to be used in construction. He thought that building projects did too much on site, that it would be more efficient to have these fiber blocks manufactured in advance. So kind of he seems like an early inspiration for Fuller in a way. But they would build these buildings, and they built 240 buildings actually, but these projects just started to lose money consistently. And also these fiber blocks apparently had some issues as well. They couldn't sustain huge loads and they just had a few problems company-wide. The company would go on to struggle, and then Fuller, as a minority shareholder, ended up being forced out of the company. So this kind of just added to Fuller's misery. He was still grieving from his daughter's death. He was severely depressed. He was just anxiety-ridden, and he was drinking a lot. And now we're talking about, it's 1927, and it would prove to be a pivotal year for Fuller, and it was kind of a turning point in his life. So he's living in Chicago, and he would take these long walks along the shoreline of Lake Michigan, drinking and reflecting on his struggles. Well, on one of these walks, he got an idea that he could just kill himself, drown himself in the lake so that his family could at least get some insurance money from his death. But then he says something very strange happened to him. He was about to jump into the water when he was raised up. He felt as though he was suspended several feet above the ground, enclosed in a white sphere of light. A voice spoke directly to Fuller and declared, "From now on, You need never await temporal attestation to your thought. You think the truth. You do not have the right to eliminate yourself. You do not belong to you. You belong to the universe. Your significance will remain forever obscure to you, but you may assume that you are fulfilling your role if you apply yourself to converting your experiences to the highest advantage of others. Okay, some heady stuff. But after this experience, Fuller said that it led him to a profound re-examination of his life. And this is where his myth-building really starts. Fuller would regale this experience to audiences and friends many times throughout his life. The story would change details and get more extravagant as his life went on. And in Fuller's own words, he said, "The search for the principles governing the universe and help advance the evolution of humanity in accordance with them, finding ways of doing more with less to the end that all people everywhere can have more and more." I feel like he was trying to give a compelling story to his audiences. He probably told himself this myth more times than he ever told anyone else. You know, he's got to build up and reinforce his purpose, right? He gave himself a purpose in life. So haven't you ever looked back on your own life and found these like pivotal moments? Maybe you have, maybe you haven't, but you know, I can certainly draw from my own life, and I've probably inflated certain things in my past a little more than they were as a way of like reinforcing an idea that I believed in or a motivation. He just did this on another level outwardly to the public. So at this time, Fuller says he basically had told his wife that he didn't need to worry about work and he was going to quietly study for 2 years. He actually told audiences this, that he's quietly studying. Well, this is just more myth building. He was definitely working and he was speaking to people. He was promoting his 4D house. So he was definitely talking, but he actually didn't come up, you know, he's promoting this 4D house and he actually didn't come up with the term Dymaxium himself. He was presenting his model house. He called it his 4D house. And he was talking to the public relations department at Marshall Field's department store in Chicago. This is 1929. And at the time, they were selling very modern furniture, and they really liked his idea. You know, they thought it kind of went along with their brand. So they could see his vision for this house, and they wanted help. They hired a publicist to help him come up with a better name for the house. And they combined three words. Apparently, it was three words that Fuller himself really liked. But it was dynamic, maximum, and tension. And that's where, you know, Dymaxian. So the problem was that his idea started to circulate. And then all sorts of people in the construction industry got concerned. And I mean, he was challenging their paradigm. You know, he had this modular bathroom. And plumbers were like outraged by it because it was way easier to install. And it would not require nearly as much work from a plumber. So he was challenging all these paradigms and threatening their established industries. And with that, the interest in his house would fade and he would lose funding for it. So we've all heard this tale before, haven't we? There's this established industry that feels threatened by innovation and fights back against it. Well, Fuller wouldn't give up. He never would. He recognized this problem and decided to attack it a different way. He created an architectural journal. He actually bought an architectural journal. I think it was called T-Squared, and he renamed it Shelter. And he actually published from it anonymously, spreading the virtues of his Dymaxian house, trying a little propaganda on for size. But this magazine was pretty short-lived, and Fuller would have kind of a failure on his hands. It didn't work out, but he wouldn't give up. He would fail over and over and never get discouraged. Maybe more myth building, you know, he says this in all his speeches, but I mean, really, did he give up? It's looking back in his life, the results kind of speak for themselves, as we'll get to. So around the same time, Fuller met Isamu Noguchi, and he was an artist and furniture designer. And Fuller and Noguchi first encountered each other in 1929 at Romany Marie's Cafe in Greenwich Village, New York. At this time, Fuller was living in Greenwich Village and spending much of his time in the cafe, and he would give these informal lectures and exhibit models of the Dymaxion house. This was back when he was really in the swing of selling his house. And he's kind of a mentor to Noguchi. He kind of becomes this mentor, and Noguchi's just mesmerized by Fuller. So together, Fuller and Noguchi would invent the next thing that Fuller's next obsession, which would be the Dymaxion car. And they would become lifelong friends in the process of designing this car. But as for the car itself, it was designed to be aerodynamic. Like I said, it was like a teardrop shape, but its goal wasn't to be sexy. You know, I know I said it was ugly, and I stand by that. It was ugly, but its goal is to be highly fuel efficient. It actually got 30 miles per gallon, which is amazing back then. It could also go 90 miles per hour. And if you look at this old thing, can you imagine seeing it go 90 miles per hour? It's kind of amazing, especially considering the fact that it had three wheels. It had two wheels in the front and one wheel in the back. That the wheel in the back did the steering. So this allowed it to be able to pull into a parking space without having to back up as well. It could also carry 11 people, which was very roomy. It was kind of like an early minivan, though it was kind of big. This car would be unveiled at the 1933 World's Fair in Chicago. The ultimate goal of the Dymaxion car, though, it was to be this omni-medium transport vehicle that could potentially fly, swim, and drive. They even stated that this prototype was just to perfect taxiing on the ground. They were really serious about making this vehicle fly. They were not messing around. But unfortunately, at the fair, a tragedy happened. There's a demonstration of the Dymaxion car, and the car struck another vehicle, and the driver of the Dymaxion car died. The Dymaxion car had been driven by Francis Turner, who was actually a professional race car driver, and the accident resulted in Turner's death, unfortunately, and it seriously injured the two passengers that were also in the car for the demonstration. And initially, the media, they blamed the Dymaxion car's unconventional design for the accident, but later it was revealed that a local politician had actually caused the crash by colliding with the Dymaxion car. I just imagine the mayor from the movie Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs just carelessly driving along, la-da-da-da-da, and then suddenly just destroying an expensive prototype. Anyway, I just couldn't get that out of my head. But despite these facts, the public had kind of just written off the Dymaxion car. They'd already made their mind up, and Fuller lost all his funding for this. Again, losing his funding, again failing. This is what, his third failure, fourth failure, if you count college. I mean, he's just had a lot of failures already. And he's halfway through his life. You know, he's in his mid-30s right now. But the Dymaxion car might not have been the revolution that Fuller was hoping for, but it started to give him this recognition as this visionary inventor and thinker. And in a way, the project was a success. So now he's starting to fail upwards now. He just kept putting himself out there. You know, nobody should ever forget that. If nobody's ever going to put your dreams in your lap. That's why they say follow your dreams. Fuller had a dream, and he sure as hell followed it. So from here on out, Fuller would be known as a futurist. Somebody who was a visionary that could see things and, you know, could see around what was around the corner, what was coming next. So he had this reputation, this recognition. So he wouldn't call himself a futurist, though. He would say he was a comprehensive anticipatory design scientist. I mean, slow down, buddy. Slow down. just stick with futurists. That's more simple. In 1938, he would write a book called Nine Chains to the Moon. And this was actually a wide-ranging collection of thoughts, essays, and observations on various topics. From this, Fuller's theory of ephemerization would actually come. And that's this idea that technology tends to produce more with less, potentially leading to near total dematerialization in the future. And I mean, he's talking way future, but he's kind of talking about miniaturization, right? Consider the clock. Consider a clock for a second. The first mechanical clocks were large, really big, right? And they required a lot of engineering and design. You know, you got gears and sprockets and everything in there. But later, these clocks would be small enough to fit on your wrist. Then these clocks went digital, and they would have even fewer moving parts and components. So, you know, just simplifying and miniaturizing. But, I mean, now think today, the clocks or smartwatches on a wrist can do more than a computer the size of a warehouse could in 1960. That's the ephemerization. The amount of resources to do the same thing becomes much less over time. He kind of thought that that was a principle of evolution or nature, sort of, or at least human nature. I think he was kind of being a little hopeful there, but he kept working on automobile designs, and into the 1940s is when he would start working on those and actually building those DDUs for the military. But then the next big thing would come along. While teaching at Black Mountain College in North Carolina, he began developing his geodesic dome design. The first dome was actually built in Germany by Walter Bauersfeld for a planetarium. Fuller, though, he kind of gets the credit for inventing and reinventing the dome structure because he coined the term geodesic and he popularized it, and his worked really well. This guy was obsessed with polyhedra, so like spherical shapes that have flat surfaces. He would experiment with different shapes for the faces of his domes. He tried hexagons, pentagons, and he would often use triangles. In his mind, these domes were highly efficient, and he would actually prove it. So he got a big break in 1953. The Ford Motor Company wanted to renovate their visitor center in Dearborn, Michigan. Their rotunda, it sounded like it was a small building at first when I first read this, but the rotunda had, it's actually this 93-foot diameter inner courtyard that engineers, they wanted to enclose it, so put a roof over it. But the structure, it was basically a ring structure, and it wasn't designed to support a massive weight that a traditional dome would be. So Fuller's geodesic dome design, it used interlocking panels, and it would work. It was much lighter. So here's how revolutionary it was. A traditional dome, it would weigh like 150 tons. And this was a pretty big dome, okay? But Fuller's design, his dome, once completed, only weighed 8.2 tons. So that's about 5% the weight of a traditional dome. So this was just proof that Fuller, he was really onto something with his geodesic dome design, and it really showcased his ideas about efficiency and innovative architecture. Sadly, though, this visitor center, it burned down in 1962. It's so sad. It was around for only less than 10 years. But look up old pictures of this building. It is really cool. So then in 1954, Fuller would receive a patent for geodesic domes, and he's really starting to build his career around them. This same year, Fuller starts working with the architect Soji Sato, and they worked on many projects together throughout their lives. They designed, in their early years, though, they designed this theoretical dome over Manhattan. And it sounds like some sci-fi stuff, but according to Fuller, the larger a geodesic dome was made, the stronger it would become proportionally. This concept is known as the synergetic advantage of geodesic structures. So he found that there was a logarithmic ratio that showed that the total strength of a geodesic dome would increase with its size. And so this goes right back to his idea of doing more with less. It's stronger the bigger it is, and exponentially stronger. So this added to a system called energetic synergetic geometry, which was based on the idea that nature has a vectorial system of forces providing maximum strength with minimum structure. And I'll talk a little bit more about these vectors later. But Fuller and Sato were great collaborators. They would go on to design this Dymaxion map. And why a map? These guys are architects. Why are they making a map, right? Well, they were designers too. And the map was sort of a way of showing the world that we were all in this together. It depicted Earth's continents as one island, so kind of, you know, centrally laying it out so that the middle is where the closest parts of the two main continent bodies are closest together. And it was also, he thought it would make people see the world differently, really. He really, really believed that the only way forward was if the entire planet worked together. So, you know, there's a lot of problems in the world, but that's one problem that seems very difficult for him to solve. But this is where he would come up with this concept of Spaceship Earth, in which he demonstrates that we are all on this planet together and should cooperate to keep it working for the sake of our own survival. The Dymaxion map, while it didn't really take off as a big successful idea, it did give Fuller and Sato time to collaborate more, and they would go on to work on many architectural projects together. During this time, though, Fuller formed two companies, Synergetics and Geodesics, to develop domes for government and for commercial use. This seemed to keep Fuller plenty busy during the 1950s. Also, remember, he's approaching 60 years old now, and he just kind of keeps reinventing himself and working on new projects. If you haven't noticed that he's also moving all over the place. Let's see, he's lived in Massachusetts, Chicago, North Carolina, New York. He just didn't have any quit in him. He just went where he needed to do what he needed to do. But his lectures were drawing more people, and he was still known as this futurist moving into the 60s, sort of like a futurist of his day, like Ray Kurzweil is today. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's kind of a big name in the futurist world. But these guys are kind of similar in a way. Kurzweil's a pretty interesting guy. I'll have to cover him sometime. But the U.S. military would actually be one of Fuller's biggest clients. Around this time, they'd use his domes to cover radar stations around the Arctic Circle. But beyond this, Fuller would continue to develop his domes in other areas. And in 1964, Fuller and Sato would form an architectural firm, Fuller and Sato, which would formalize their partnership together. And their first major project was designing this large geodesic dome for the U.S. Pavilion at Expo 67 in Montreal. So it's just like another World's Fair. And this building is still there. It's known as the Montreal Biosphere now. And it looks like it's from the future even today. It's really cool structure. It's a very rather large dome. It's really, really neat though. But so now Fuller is almost 70 years old. You know, he never gave up on himself, and he just keeps turning these failures into this fertilizer for his next project. It's just so, you know, refreshing and cool to see just like, no matter how many times you think you'd fail, as long as you just keep going, you never know what's around the corner. And the geodesic dome, sure, these domes weren't exactly runaway successful. He didn't exactly become like filthy rich from them. But today, there are over 300,000 geodesic domes around the world. Not all built by Fuller, of course, but his design principles would do just as he had hoped they'd live past his lifetime. He called this approach he had to geometry, he'd call it synergetic geometry. And this actually is the foundation that his philosophy and design principles would be based on. It's really hard to grasp stuff, but essentially he was trying to understand fundamental principles of the universe through spatial relationships and patterns. So now in the 1970s, we're talking, Fuller is, he would become the second president of Mensa. And if you're not familiar with Mensa, they're a social organization for people with high intelligence. Now, you might think this is just a group of people who like to pat each other on the back for how smart they are. Now, I tend to think of them as any kind of other social group. There's people that get together that share the same trauma, right? There's people with certain disabilities or, you know, people with problems or areas of interest, people with similar hobby groups. And then you have groups like Mensa, where people who think in a like-minded way can get together and exchange ideas on the same level, you know, and they just enjoy each other's company because it's an enriching environment for them. So for Fuller to become the president of the Smart Kids Club, it kind of shows how intelligent he was. You have to score within the top 2% of a recognized intelligence test just to get into the group. Fuller did so many things in his life. I just can't cover it all in one podcast. But Fuller would actually die on July 1st, 1983, and this was just 11 days before his 88th birthday. During the period leading up to his death, his wife had been lying comatose in a Los Angeles hospital, and she was dying of cancer. And it was while visiting her there that he exclaimed at a certain point, "She's squeezing my hand." He then stood up, had a heart attack, and died an hour later at 87 years old. His wife of 66 years died 36 hours later. In his memory, the Buckminster Fuller Institute exists, and they seek to honor the legacy of Buckminster Fuller and continue his effort to make the world work for all life in the shortest possible time through spontaneous cooperation. And BFI was founded in 1983, and it was for this very purpose, to inspire and support new generations of design science and innovation. And they just want to extend what he was doing when he died and just support his whole concept and kind of humanitarian effort. In his life, he received 28 patents, published 30 books, was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize multiple times, though he never won. But he taught at Harvard and MIT. Actually, he gave lectures at over 500 educational institutions worldwide. He really lectured a lot, and I didn't really touch on that as much, but a lot of what he lectured about are the things that we're talking about. So kind of a doubling up, covering the same thing anyway. But he appeared on the cover of Time magazine. He received numerous honorary doctorates and also published a book called Synergetics in 1975, which was a book that presented an alternative mathematical system, sort of. I don't know that calling it a mathematical system is correct. It's a whole new discipline. It's not math. It's not physics. It's not chemistry. It's synergetics. I didn't know we were allowed to do that, to make our own discipline. But that's what Buckminster Fuller did, and that's what we're going to talk about next. So put your thinking caps on, because this is some heavy shit. This doesn't take us directly to Mensa. It's kind of a side road, to be honest, but it's something we found along our travels here while doing this research, and I just can't not talk about it a little bit, and it'll also help understand a little more about Buckminster Fuller. So first, let's talk about his thoughts on geometry a bit further to prepare us for the synergetic part of this whole thing. So he rejected the Cartesian coordinate system, you know, the line plots with the point in the middle and negative and positive XY axes. Instead, he proposed an alternative coordinate system based on the tetrahedron and the isotopic vector matrix. So if you're wondering, a tetrahedron is a 3D shape with four triangular faces. So just think of a three-sided pyramid. And he considered this the most basic shape. As far as the isotropic vector matrix, let's break it down a little. Isotropic means everywhere the same. Vector refers to the lines of energy, and matrix is a pattern of these lines of energy. So, like a grid made up of these interlocking triangles instead of squares, but in three dimensions. So imagine a bunch of marbles. This might help. Okay. Imagine a bunch of marbles, and all these marbles are the same size. Lay them in a shoebox and maybe tilt the shoebox so that all the marbles are clumped together. The points between the centers of all these circles would form this interlocking vector matrix. And because of the way the spheres are placed, it's the most efficient way to put these spheres together, right? The most dense way you can pack spheres. If you've ever just, you can kind of imagine, they're kind of like zigzag interlocking in the way that they connect. But it you know, you might get that and go, okay. But it gets, I'm so sorry, it gets more complicated because his interlocking vector matrix is more fully explained in four dimensions, not three. I'm not really happy about it either. I'm not happy about it at all, but I was really happy with the marble thing, but then he made it more complicated. So hang on. So in a three dimensions, you have XYZ coordinates, right? It's Euclidean, and it's this 90 degree coordinated system. So think of a cube. It has six sides, but really three pairs of sides in the same direction, right? So you have three axes. So each corner of a cube has this 90 degree angle on it, right? For each side, you with me? And that's the Euclidean nature of the cube. Okay, so now let's talk about how Fuller saw things. Now, a tetrahedron, remember, this is that three-sided pyramid with the base that's also a triangle. So it's a four-sided shape, right? You've got, you've really essentially got four triangular faces that interlock into a shape. And all of these faces are equilateral triangles. So all the angles of the shape are 60 degrees. Remember from school, maybe all the angles of a triangle always add up to 180 degrees. So when Fuller refers to his isotropic vector matrix, this IVM, he refers to these 60 degree coordinated systems. That's what he means, that every angle is a 60 degree angle between the points. So you can visualize this matrix, this IVM matrix in 3D space, but it's the conceptual framework around it that it has four dimensions. There's four directions that the vectors can travel inside of this matrix. And Fuller believed that this four-dimensional geometry was more accurate to reality and the universe we live in than the 3D Euclidean coordinate system. Yeah, I know. But, so, you might be like, yeah, right, but 3D is 3D. I can sit there and look at a cube. Three dimensions makes sense. It's easier to visualize in your head, right? Okay, well, here's something interesting that I'm drawing from my own experience here, but I'm not the best at geometry. I don't really, you know, I barely remember geometry from school, but it did remind me of something. I used to develop video games, and there's this concept called gimbal lock, and it's kind of an interesting problem for video games that they had to overcome in three-dimensional games for objects that rotated in three dimensions. You could end up with this, mathematically, you'd end up with it not being able to rotate correctly, and it would break. The programming would break. The math just does not work. I don't want to get into gimbal lock too much. Maybe I'll write an article about gimbal lock. That'd be really, real spicy, huh? But Euclidean geometry, it's just insufficient at avoiding gimbal lock. And so many modern video games, they use something called a quaternion, which is the objects in the game, they rotate on four-dimensional axes. So video games are trying to represent a digital reality themselves, and they're needing to use four dimensions to do it for these rotating objects. So don't quite think Fuller is a crackpot with his 4D, you know, IVM matrix thing. It's very much a reality. But as hard as that is to visualize in an audio podcast, it's just, let's take a look at synergetics now as a whole, because it's less geometry and lines and more conceptual, and it's more broad than geometry. It's, although the geometry is a big part of synergetics because it does represent part of what synergetics is, but here's the nerd definition of synergetics to be, this is how it's written out. And it says, a system of measuration employing 60-degree vectorial coordination, so that's the IVM matrix, comprehensible to both physics and chemistry, and to both arithmetic and geometry in rational whole numbers. Synergetics explains much that has not been previously illuminated. Synergetics follows the cosmic logic of the structural mathematics strategies of nature, which employ the paired sets of the six angular degrees of freedom, frequencies, and vectorially economical actions, and their multi-alternative equi-economical action options. Synergetics discloses the excruciating awkwardness characterizing present-day mathematical treatment of the interrelationships of the independent scientific disciplines, I'm almost done, I promise, as originally occasioned by their mutual and separate lacks of awareness of the existence of a comprehensive, rational, coordinating system inherent in nature. Jesus fucking Christ. What the hell is he even saying here? But in a more distilled down version of this, a way more simple version of this, in layman's terms, it's the most basic principle is that synergetics is the study of systems empirically. Did you get that from that paragraph? It's because I didn't. But it's this basis on the emphasis of the whole system's behavior. The idea is that you cannot understand a system by looking at its individual parts alone. You have to look at the whole system to get a more complete understanding of it. Remember, like, if something is greater than the sum of its parts, don't you have to look at the endpoint? Because if you take those separate pieces and try to add them together, you can't, because you need to look at the system as a whole. This whole idea has been it's been called by critics as sort of experimental mathematics, but it's not just the geometry, it's applying that geometry to the physical sciences and also kind of other things, relationships in general. For example, imagine watching a flock of birds moving together in the sky. From a distance, it looks like a single fluid organism, changing shape and direction in unison. Each bird's flying individually, sure, but the overall behavior of the flock is not something one bird is consciously controlling. Instead, the flock's complex movement patterns emerge from the interactions between all the individual birds. So these patterns that emerge in the flock, such as these waves of movement or sudden changes in the direction, these are considered emergent behaviors. So in this way, the flock exhibits behaviors that are greater than the sum of its parts. So if you were just watching one bird, you wouldn't predict this big, beautiful, coordinated movement of the whole thing. You'd have to look at the collective actions of the entire system to see how they produce new properties that these individual components don't possess on their own. So while the Beatles would harmonize together and come up with the greatest music ever made, in my opinion. Sorry, I'm a huge Beatles fan. But these flocks of birds would move in unison and create this emergent behavior that not one bird is coming up with on their own. So Fuller would also apply geometric concepts to explain how nature optimizes resources and energy. It's almost like he considers it to be inevitable. Like, this is just how nature works, is what he's saying. So just like how a flock of birds moves smoothly with minimal effort, synergetics emphasizes how natural systems like atoms or whole ecosystems organize efficiency through geometric and energetic relationships. So at its core, synergetics studies how systems can achieve synergetic outcomes that are greater than the sum of their parts. To just keep repeating the same thing over and over again, this is really the whole principle of it. Fuller would more broadly state synergetics as the behavior of a whole system that cannot be predicted by the behavior of their parts taken separately. So it's kind of a sort of different way of looking at it. But so I think one way you could apply this is to take a system, any system, and try to make it work more synergetically. I mean, really, we're talking about efficiency, aren't we? But to be more efficient, maybe you have to be more synergetic, really. So for a simple example, aspirin and caffeine, they're put in the same pill for a reason, because separately, they don't provide the pain relief, nearly as much pain relief. That's why there's caffeine in aspirin. It makes aspirin more potent. So then the same thing is true with radiation therapy and chemotherapy. They're used more effectively together at impeding cancer cell growth than either treatment used alone. They're exponentially better together. I mean, and then you have the kind of a seedier side of synergetics. There's a lot of business acquisitions and corporate business solutions are seen as synergetic. Walmart isn't just successful for selling a bunch of garbage in a large building. They vertically integrated their product pipeline, creating synergy by buying their own manufacturing facilities and creating their own distribution networks. They took a system and they just made it more efficient, which at its core, you know, you might not like Walmart for all their other shady stuff or even for this, because it allowed them to bully other companies or outcompete them by selling their own cheaper versions of this product, swallowing up market share and killing many businesses. But at its core, it was a synergetic solution. It just wasn't holistic and beneficial to mankind. Fuller probably would not approve of Walmart at all, to be clear. I don't know how well he really viewed capitalism, because it feels like it kind of runs counter. I don't want to get down like he never really talked about being a communist or anything like that. He was kind of a celebrated guy, but he just felt like cooperation was an absolute necessity. But the business world, they kind of co-opted the word synergy a little bit. You do hear it a little bit from time to time. I think the first time I ever heard the word was in the movie In Good Company. Malcolm Gladwell plays this role where he's kind of gutting this company and he keeps saying, we need to make synergy. And it's not a very good movie. It's okay. It's like a rom-com, take it or leave it. But I might dig into synergetics more into the future. It seems interesting. There's a lot more than what I covered. I actually found a copy of the book and I started reading it, and it is a very, very bizarre book. I mean, the first part of the book tries to explain how a child sees the world, like his eyesight. Like, it gets into like how eyes work and stuff. It's out there. It's heavy stuff. And it doesn't seem like synergetics was really, it's just not that popular topic. Go ahead, go to YouTube and look up synergetics and see how much real information you get. There's a lot of, you know, like most of the videos were like, you know, showing shapes with soundtracks and stuff. Like, clearly people didn't really dig into what this all meant or understood. It kind of feels like synergetics as a discipline, as a science, was kind of abandoned in a way, but I'm sure a lot of his concepts are used just more as in applied ways. I do kind of wonder if the theoretical physics community ever embraced some of his ideas. It's way too complicated for me to even go farther than what I did on this, but maybe in the future I'll look into that further and report back, or maybe you can. You figure it out. This shit was complicated, man. But anyway, so now that we're all primed, we've got you primed. You're ready, I think, to join Mensa. So let's see if we can. Maybe you're already in Mensa. Maybe you're that one person listening to this podcast that's in it. But assuming you're not, let's see if we can't bluff your way into Mensa. So I mentioned Mensa earlier, so you should already kind of know it's the high IQ club, right? Imagine you're a very intelligent person. I have to imagine it myself because maybe it's not hard for you. I don't know. Maybe you are already a very intelligent person. If you're listening to this podcast, you must be, right? Okay, whatever. So your mind is full of complex, interesting ideas. You want to talk to your friends about them, but your friends are all dummies and they want to talk about sports or boobs or something. I don't know. Whatever the standard folk talk about, right? So if you're a human and everyone around you is basically a golden retriever, you might get lonely. You might crave some intellectual discourse with a fellow gifted human such as yourself. Sounds pretty good, right? Great. Let's see if you can get you in the door at Mensa. There's actually two ways to test to get into Mensa. For one, you can take a supervised test session from a Mensa person. Mensa member, I guess I should say. These tests are designed and supervised by Mensa and are specifically intended to determine if you qualify for membership. The other way is if you've already been taken an intelligence test that Mensa accepts, you can submit your results to Mensa. But these tests also have to be supervised by either a licensed psychologist or a testing service and score you in the 98th percentile. Remember, you have to be in the top 2%. And the psychologist part kind of threw me for a second. I was like, why a psychologist? But they actually do conduct IQ tests regularly, but it's usually to check for lower IQ. But there's also ethical reasons for having a psychologist oversee it. They're known to possess this quality called integrity, you know, whatever the fuck that is. But so let's say you pass, and now you're on the inside of the Smart Kids Club. Great. Good job. The whole standard brain gang is proud of you, though we'll miss the discourse and you'll miss us talking about our lawns and the latest HBO show that definitely won't suck in the last season. But your mission as a member of Mensa, now that you're in the club, here's our mission statement: to identify and foster human intelligence for the benefit of humanity, to encourage research into the nature, characteristics, and uses of intelligence, to promote stimulating intellectual and social opportunities for its members. As a Mensa member, you'd be invited to social events, speaker events, games, and discussions on a wide range of topics. You'd get national and international newsletters or magazines that cover intellectual topics, puzzles, and also news about the organization. You'd also have the chance to join like more specialized groups in your particular fields of interest. And just to hammer it home, think about the flow of ideas in some of these specialized groups. These overlapping research, the new ideas being exchanged with friends and colleagues, it's kind of like synergy, right? Okay. I'm not going to hit on that too hard, but you have a good deal of company as a member in Mensa. There are 100,000 members of Mensa internationally. And to be clear about Mensa and their membership, they only have one requirement: a high IQ. They don't care if you're a broom handle or a Cajun. Your sex doesn't matter. Your gender doesn't matter. Your culture, religions, politics, they don't matter. If you're smart, you can join. That's pretty cool, I think. So since you've now gotten the introduction to the group you just got in, why don't you learn a little bit about the history of Mensa? You don't want to be caught not knowing who its founders are, after all. So Mensa started by two men in 1946. Ronald Barrow, who was a lawyer with an interest in social equality and human potential. And then there was Dr. Lance Ware, who was a scientist and lawyer with a deep interest in intelligence and its measurement. yeah, these two guys that founded Mensa, and yeah, they're both lawyers, which actually, Mensa actually means table, though, and to promote intelligent, so to sit at a table, to, I think that was kind of the concept, was that it was an idea that's like, this is a group, sits at a table, exchanges ideas. So they envisioned Mensa at where people could, as a place where people could engage in this stimulating and intellectual conversation and foster this creativity and knowledge sharing. And they really had their hearts in a good place, it seems. They wanted to contribute to society, and it grew into this international organization with chapters all over the world. It's pretty cool, really. And these guys both sounded like like-minded people to Fuller, so it's no wonder he would join and become the second president of the group. They probably were smitten with him when he joined. So just to be a little tabloidy here, though, just because it's kind of fun and we just got done with a very intellectually challenging thing, at least for me. So some of the famous members of Mensa include none other than Stephen Hawking. He was apparently a member. I mean, this is kind of a given, right? Big surprise. Stephen Hawking. Come on. Carl Sagan. Again, not a big surprise, but really cool. Richard Branson apparently has been associated with Mensa. Sharon Stone was reported to be in Mensa, but it sounds like that was BS. There's several people like that seem to get, oh yeah, I think they were in Mensa. Gina Davis apparently was in Mensa, and she's been associated with it. To not just mention famous people's names, there's Terence Tao. He won the Fields Medal in 2006. So the same medal that the Fields Medal is basically the Nobel Prize in math, or basically the equivalent. There's a lot of speculation about people being members. I mean, there's, I think it was Billy Joel. I was going down a rabbit hole trying to figure out if Billy Joel was in Mensa, and people on Reddit are like, nah, he wasn't in Mensa. Like, yeah, he's in Mensa. It's like, who cares? I gave up researching it because I just told myself, this doesn't matter. This is stupid. Why am I still doing this? So that's it. That's the episode. We've gone from tiny houses to the Dymaxion house to Buckminster Fuller and his bizarre life. We took a detour to talk about synergetics. And then we tried to get you into Mensa, which I think we did a pretty good job on that. So now it's time for our character review. First, we have Jay Schaefer, the pioneer of the tiny house movement. He solved multiple problems with one solution. He did more with less. I think Buckminster Fuller would absolutely approve of Mr. Schaefer. And then there was Lester Walker, briefly mentioned, for writing the book Tiny Houses, which would be an inspiration for Schaefer. So, I mean, good job. And then there's the big banks. I had to put them in here. They're the main cause of the housing market collapse, and he needed a bad guy for this episode. And who's really over that? Is anybody actually over that housing market? I'm not over that. They're the asshole of the episode. So then there's the opposite of that. There's the Buckminster Fuller, the fearless visionary, never gave up. He revolutionized the car, the house. He'd become famous for his geodesic domes and for his incredible, unique way of thinking. He is the hero of the episode, of course, for just never giving up on himself and believing in his vision and kind of being a role model for others, if you ask me. And then there's Anne Hewlett, Fuller's wife, who I'm sorry I didn't say more about her. I feel like I should have said more about her. I just couldn't find as much information on her. But she stayed married to him for 66 years, despite losing a child and Fuller basically being fired by her stepfather, or by her father, his stepfather. Hewlett was creative in her own right, too, having attended the New York School of Applied Design for Women and later designed a cottage for her family. She's sort of an unsung hero in this story. It's believed that Fuller actually relied heavily on her throughout his life. She supported Fuller through various career changes and financial difficulties. I mean, she had to go along for all of these moves, all these crazy ideas, these career changes. Their relationship was very certainly enduring, just as he was, so she really should share in all of his credit. And then there was James Monroe Hewlett, Anne's father, who gave Fuller a big break, letting him join his architectural firm. kind of probably was an early role model, only to turn around and fire Fuller from the Stockade Corporation when it failed in 1927. And then there's Fuller's friend, Isamu Noguchi, the designer that would collaborate with Fuller on several projects, including the Demaxian car. And then later, there was the architect, Shoji Sato, who he collaborated with Fuller and created an architectural firm with him. And they created that Montreal biosphere together that still stands. And then finally, we have Roland Barrel and Dr. Lance Ware, the founders of Mensa, who wanted to cultivate a higher place of cultivate a place for highly intelligent people to share their ideas together. And Buckminster Fuller, he often worked with others on his projects. Did you notice? He joined Mensa. He became its second president. I think he was fully conscious of his decisions to work cooperatively with others. He understood that people needed to cooperate to succeed. And he considered Earth to be this spaceship as a way of saying we're all in this together and should proceed that way. Specifically on that, he said, "We are not going to be able to operate our spaceship Earth successfully, nor for much longer, unless we see it as a whole spaceship and our fate as common. It has to be everybody or nobody." Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. If you have any feedback for the episode, email feedback@meridianspodcast.com. And if you want to read some companion articles I've written for the show, check out my Substack. It is meridianspodcast.substack.com. And if you like the podcast, head on over there and subscribe to my newsletter. And every week I'll publish new content and you'll have the opportunity to support the show there if you'd like to. But for now, I'm Charlie Noble. Thank you to my family, Jenny, Julian, and Eleanor, for supporting me. Well, at least Jenny and Julian support me. Eleanor's a dog, so she kind of supports me. But anyway, they give me the chance to work on this podcast and, you know, support my work. And also thank you to the dreamers and visionaries out there that just never give up. Learn from your mistakes and pick yourself up and just keep going.